This is The Crucible. The JRTC Experience.
Good afternoon from the State Department's Brussels Media.
Greetings from the U.S. Department of State's Asia Pacific Media.
Today we are very pleased to be joined.
Often in remote or challenging locations, these elections are an inspiring example.
Good afternoon from the State Department's Brussels Media.
Good afternoon to everyone.
I welcome our participants logging in.
To play a critical role in advancing prosperity, democracy, and stability across the Indo-Pacific.
This is where we discuss warfighting skills and lessons learned in a decisive action training environment for large-scale combat operations at JRTC.
Hi, I'm Colonel Matt Hardman, the Commander of Operations Group here at the Joint Readiness Training Center, and thanks for joining us for another episode of the Crucible Experience, the JRTC Experience. We're joined by a special guest today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, sir. I'm Captain Will Happel from the Princess of Wales' Royal Regiment. I'm the British Exchange Officer here at JRTC.
And, fortunate to have him here, infantry officer. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so I consider myself very fortunate to be here as well, sir. I've really enjoyed my time here. I have developed recently a bit of a background in collective training. I spent 2 years at the Combat Ready Training Center in the UK doing light and light mech collective training events before then coming out here to continue doing rotations in the box.
Okay, and then, we're losing you.
Yeah.
You're off to Fort Leavenworth, right?
That's correct, sir. Yeah.
So there's some lucky staff group that's getting Will here in their group. As some of you that know me out there know, I'm a giant nerd, and Will and I got to talking about books, and so he brought one of my favorite books for our profession, Three Commando Brigade in the Falklands, No Picnic, by General Julian Thompson. The Falklands campaign and experience, part of why I find this book really interesting, and I read this book before I took over as a brigade trainer at the National Training Center, was looking for something that would help me get my head around brigade operations and large-scale combat operations. And what really stood out to me is, one, the British experience in the Falklands, it's inherently expeditionary. I think it's 8,000 miles away from home.
Kilometers. That sounds about right. It's pretty far. I don't know if it's that far, but
8,
it's thousands.
Kilometers,
it's thousands, yeah.
Metric. It's austere. So they're down there in what would be the winter in the southern hemisphere. And it's, the Argentine military, near peer competitor when we look at the capabilities, night vision equipment, air defense systems, really at the beginning of the campaign, air superiority, and a tough, well-trained adversary down there. So from your perspective, tell me about the Falklands campaign and sort of the memory of the British Army.
Yeah, I will do. So I have to be a little bit careful because I personally have never been to the Falklands, and quite a lot of people in the UK military have, so I've not seen the ground for myself. I also come from a regiment where our forebears missed out on going to the Falklands. So we had a battalion that was in Northern Ireland at the time and a battalion that went to Northern Ireland shortly after the Falklands. So I don't have that same deeply ingrained regimental memory of the Falklands. And the regiments that went there, it's still very, very much a part of their identity today. It's still referenced very regularly throughout training. So most of our infantry training courses have a real Falklands flavor to them. They're night attacks, uphills, in the rain, generally quite cold weather against a tenacious, well-dug in enemy. So it's still very much at the forefront of the sort of psyche, certainly in the regiments that have that in their history.
Yeah, and for the U.S. light infantry community in particular, I mean, even with all the experiences in Afghanistan, Iraq, the experience in Mogadishu in 1993 with the Ranger Regiment still, has this undercurrent of the way we approach a lot of things, and deeply ingrained lessons learned from that experience. And different but similar. I think the my reading of the history is that's very much the case in the British military.
Yeah, I think it certainly is, sir. And I think if I could paint a picture for what the campaign was like, maybe a bit from the ground perspective and naval as well, it's personal because today we're recording on the 26th of May, So on this day 41 years ago, the campaign was ongoing. Three commando brigade have landed a few days prior, and they're just stepping off. So two para-battle group are they're conducting their prelim moves down towards Goose Green. They've come down off of Sussex Mountain, heading southeast to Camilla House. Three para are heading up towards Teal Inlet Settlement, and 45 commando are starting their yomp east. So the ground forces
it's
are
yomp.
That's a Marine term for
what's
march.
It, what's
yeah.
it, march?
Yeah, march. We would call it tabbing, tactical advance to battle.
Tab.
Yeah.
Tactical advance battle.
To battle, yes.
And,
yeah.
we, and to battle. Yeah. And we would call it rucking.
Yep. Yeah, yomping, and, rucking, tabbing.
Yeah, yeah, all underneath the green tick. And the green tick being, you know, the Bergen in
yep.
British parlay.
Yep.
The rucksack and, you know, the green tick because it's sucking the life out of you as you carry it. And so, you know, one of the things that stands out is the intense loads.
Yes.
That folks are under.
80 pounds is what they quote in here, roughly per person. But the ground is pretty unforgiving. You've got boggy ground, so swampy, mushy ground that they're sort of wading through, and then you've got these rock rivers. As I say, I've never seen it, but I have seen pictures of it. And it, if you imagine a river, but it's made of boulders that are 3 feet in diameter, 6 feet in diameter, you're having to navigate that with heavy loads. So it looks good because the brigade have landed so far. They've got most of their combat power ashore, and they're now stepping off on the advance. But the wider campaign's actually looking pretty negative at this point. So the day before, HMS Coventry has been sunk and destroyed. Atlantic Conveyor has been destroyed, along with all of the helicopters bar one.
Right.
And then 2 days prior, HMS Antelope was hit by an exocet and exploded.
Yeah. So I'll back up. So, you know, the British military, this is organized as a what we would call today, you know, a joint forcible entry.
Yep.
And, you know, the Argentine Air Force is operating from the mainland, so interior lines of communication. Some Argentine Air Force and naval aviation operating from the islands themselves.
Yep.
Pretty quick outload for most units from the UK. Stop in Ascension Island. Reconfigure some loads, a little bit of light training, and
yep.
then off they go down to the Falklands. And so the original, you know, this book does a great job of laying it out. The original plan is we're going to seize a foothold on the west side of the Falklands at San Carlos, and then, you know, expand the lodgment, and then air assault to see Stanley.
Yep.
And as you point out, with the loss of the Atlantic Conveyor, we don't have any helicopters.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think we've all been there as infantiers where you're told the helicopter's coming and it doesn't, or the truck is coming and it doesn't. I think that's a good lesson from this book. Is
it's the Mike Tyson lesson. Everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth.
That's exactly it, sir, yeah. Right. And that one Chinook, interestingly, it was designated Bravo November. It then fought through both the Iraq and Afghan conflicts. It's had four pilots win Distinguished Flying Crosses in that chassis. It's now on display in RAF Museum Cosford, I think it is. Yeah, so it's had a good career.
Yeah, and really, you know, with the helicopters that the British military has left, pretty much devoted solely at this point to move in artillery, ammunition, and casualties.
Yeah, and that was something that really stood out for me in this book, was the amount of time they spend agonizing over the movement of guns and gun ammunition. It's made me realize, as an infantry commander, if you've got what you've got to move yourself, don't expect brigade to be giving you any assets, because I can guarantee you it's moving artillery ammunition or it's moving guns. So if you're sat around waiting for a truck from brigade, you best get walking.
And so, you know, I love this, you know, campaign. And I've read this book a couple times, and you've got some other ones here. I've read a series of books on this. I mean, fascinating to me professionally because of the challenges that Three Commando is placed in. You know, as you point out, at the beginning of the campaign, the British military has not achieved air superiority, let alone dominance over the area of operations. The Argentine aviation elements are being pretty effective at getting inside the bubble, which is resulting in having to move ships at night away yep. from the lodgment, so that it slows down the sustainment. And so, you know, for somebody that spent a fair bit of time in the airborne community, it's not hard to think about an airhead in the same way that, based on windows, may not be able to air land aircraft, and so this projected flow of combat power, you know, may not be what we think. And so, what stood out to you in terms of some of the challenges that they had with building combat power in the lodgment?
Yeah, so I think some of the challenges they certainly, or Brigadier Thompson certainly pointed out in the start of his book, was really getting those people ashore under the blankets of air defense, and doing so at night, preferably, or in bad weather, which was frequent, but probably not as frequent as they would have liked. And then really their air defense, until they could get those Royal Artillery air defense batteries online, which he talks about at length in here, the placement of them and how temperamental they could be with their placement, because again, they could only move them by helicopter, of which they didn't have many. Their air defense was really just small arms, and it was everyone in the brigade who had a machine gun firing up at the aircraft, which by their account seemed to work better than I'd have perhaps expected.
And then, you know, one of the things I remember from reading the book is, you know, some of the challenges they had with the pack out. And so as they loaded ships, there were items of equipment that had gone in first, which means they're coming in out last. And so that really, you know, the tactical crossload of equipment
yep.
Done in haste, including units that didn't habitually move by ship, to include the para units, you know, resulted in some surprises when they finally got to the lodgment. One being tentage for the hospital, the Roll
yep.
2.
Yeah, and also the main headquarters, they agonized over where they were going to put it, whether they were going to keep it on the ship or whether they're going to put it on land. And it's a really interesting sort of internal monologue he's having in the book, where he's talking about his thought process about sighting of the headquarters. I think it paid off. It's not, there's very rarely a right or wrong answer. The proof is
less,
in the pudding.
And less bad choices yeah. is really what he
yeah.
has.
And I think also it's that there's an element of this was a force that was pulled together for this operation and put onto ships, and they just made it work. But it's, you've got to keep that attitude. That I think is one of the most marvelous things about working in the military, is you're surrounded by people who just get things done. Nothing's ideal, but we just moan about it, of course, but we kind of accept it and just do the best we can. These ships were overloaded with people. One of his staff officers, Major Ewan Sudby Taylor, was living in a toilet for the voyage, because there just weren't enough berths for everyone on board. So people had to put up with some pretty rough conditions yeah. to make it work.
You know, I think one of the other things that's really relevant as well is, as our militaries think about large-scale combat operations, is it's joint. The whole thing is joint. I mean, we have Royal Air Force Harriers flying off of carrier decks, obviously the Royal Navy, the commandos, different army elements here, and there's friction. But, you know, to your point, is there's a bias to action, and people, you know, quickly
yeah.
work to solve the problems.
Yeah, it's a real team effort. Every service is climbing over each other to try and prove that what they're doing is of good value and having a significant impact on the campaign.
And so, you know, they get this lodgment, you know, very obviously concerned about securing the lodgment initially, you know, first from counterattack. And they use, the British use some special operations forces, one to fix units, and then two to really create deception, to create space. The landing goes better than they expect.
Mm-hmm.
Although there are frequent air attacks, they're able to get the bulk of the forces landed. And the real challenge becomes building the other parts of combat power, the not the pointy end, but munitions, sustainment,
yeah.
and expanding C2 capacity.
Yeah. I think the way in which special forces are used is very interesting because it's not a way in which we would be used to in recent times. In this, the special forces were orbited within the brigade and were working to the commando brigade. So they were supporting, in some ways, the other maneuver forces. And going and doing the usual sorts of things they do, long patrols, deception operations, raids, but really having a massive impact and buying a lot of space and time for the main body to inload, sort themselves out, and then get on the march.
And so they get the lodgement, they get the ADA systems in, imperfectly, but ultimately in, and then they look, you know, to expand this lodgement. And so, you know, there's a realization that it's all going to go slower than we thought because we don't have helicopters, mm-hmm. or we don't have the number of helicopters that we thought we'd have, and we still haven't gained air superiority. And so we, you know, results in an operation down at Goose Green, to the southeast of San Carlos. And you know, what are some of the lessons that came out of the fight from Tupera down to the Falklands? And I was fortunate; I got to do a regimental exchange with Tupera back in the early 2000s.
Oh, great!
Great outfit.
Yeah. Oh, well, they still have. I've seen them come through on exercises back in the UK before in my previous job, and they're still a very good outfit, still very up for it, busy all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the other book that I would recommend that talks specifically about Goose Green, some of the lessons learned, is Not Mentioned in Dispatches by Spencer Fitzgibbon. It shows some of the other side of Goose Green. There were BBC correspondents, and he argues that they overinflated the victory. But if you remember, the war's not going well at this point.
Right.
Brigadier Thompson is under a lot of pressure to get some sort of land victory so that they can announce it in Whitehall and announce it in Parliament and say that things are going well.
But, you know, tactically, I mean, it's a tough, you know, setting aside the operational and policy,
yep.
you know, tactically, there's an airfield down there. A number of ADA units and ground units probably outnumber Tupera 2-1. Really open terrain. I mean, this is treeless terrain, you know, and they tab down there. Pretty long movement, horrible weather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the commander, Lieutenant Colonel Jones, H. Jones, they log her up for a night, and he makes it. They put security out, but he makes the decision at some risk to put people under cover to preserve combat power. And then when they attack, you know, the really limiting factors is the amount of mortar ammunition they have, and there's a controlled supply rate of how much artillery support they'll have.
Yes,
which is something in training we often don't think about.
Yep.
That we're not going to have these endless supplies of ammunition,
They had a naval gunfire and support, which is probably every infantry officer or artillery officer's dream to one day call in naval gunfire in anger. But yeah, so HMS Arrow was in support, but they were having problems with that because it's probably the first time that they've really ever executed naval gunfire from a ground observer from the Royal Artillery.
Well, and they stay closer and longer than they were supposed to because the fight is so hard.
Yeah.
And they stay on station at pretty tremendous risk
yeah.
because of the lethality of the Argentine air attacks at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then if memory serves, they have a stoppage on the gun.
Yep.
And so, you know, the Tupera gets held up. I mean, the Argentines had prepared positions, wire mines, 50 caliber machine guns, well sighted in, you know, and this turns into, you know, the classic infantry battalion attack.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the things that come out of that fight?
Well, it's interesting look at their approaches to it. And I think they started with a very, very deliberate attack. And then it became apparent that the enemy template that they had planned off probably wasn't quite matched up with what it really was. And then they changed their approach partway through to more of a movement to contact battle drill, and they start to make a lot more progress. They also, at the tactical level, start to change their TTPs, because they're coming up against these bunkers, and they find that firing small arms at the bunkers isn't doing the trick. So they then start firing Carl Gustav and Milan into the bunkers, and after they've done that a few times, it really has a big impact on the enemy's will to fight.
Right.
Once they've seen a few of their bunkers explode with shoulder launch munitions, that has a greater effect than perhaps what they would have done normally.
And this is, you know, one of the, the British Army hadn't fought large scale combat at this point in 30 years, right? Since the Korean campaign, mm-hmm. This is 30 years. And so it's easy for us to imagine ourselves really in some respects in the same position of, as professional soldiers, nobody of our generation has experienced large-scale combat operations. And so the lessons learned from these things is, it's unfortunately, like many of us, you know, it's the relearning of hard lessons from previous campaigns.
Yeah.
The HE wins a battlefield, and that's one of those that lessons that stands out from this campaign that we see every month here. In rotation, is units learn that they got to lead with high explosive.
Yes. Yeah, you have to use high explosives. You have to dig. They mention that in this book. They probably mention it in every other modern warfare book. You've got to dig. When you stop, if you're static for a long time, you've got to dig. Put yourself on a reverse slope, get eyes on the forward slope, and then dig.
Yeah. And so, the Goose Green fight, as you describe it, what you really end up at small unit level of, section leaders, platoon leaders, company commanders, maneuvering formations to get HE in position to have a decisive impact and then exploit that gap. And really, once they're able to do that a couple times in conjunction with indirect fire, the British get in a position of advantage that really make it's a fait accompli to the Argentine forces on the ground.
Yeah.
In relatively quick order, kind of causes a cessation of activities, and then the Argentine units on the ground surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Some other things that stand out that is the casualty evacuation component of this, and the hard choices that are being made on the ground, and the importance of being able to treat and stabilize casualties on scene. And unfortunately, Colonel Jones is killed in this fight. And I think that's one of the things that stands out when I read this as well, is for the young soldiers, the sheer violence of what they've just experienced.
Yeah.
Different than the stability operations that the British, had been doing in other places in the world at the time. This is jarring of just how violent large-scale combat is against a near-peer adversary.
Yeah, you get a flavor of it from this, because the way he narrates it, it's first person as if he was within the battle group at the time. But there is a BBC documentary that came out within the last 2 years where they interview some of the people who were there, and they paint a very vivid picture of the realities of war and what it was like to attack through down into Goose Green. It's quite...
And this, how long does the action at Goose Green take? I mean, this is almost, if memory serves from reading it, it's a 12 to 18 hour fight.
That sounds about right. I'd have to double check, but I think it's more than 12 hours. And I think it was delayed about 24 hours as well because of how long it took them to get from Sussex Mountain to Goose Green. So that these guys had been on the march, living out of their rucks for several days, no sleep, very, very cold. Yeah, very cold, wet feet. They, in the documentary, one of the people who was there says that he stepped off of the landing craft into the water, and that was the last time he had dry feet for the whole campaign.
And then, so from this campaign, or this fight, the rest of the brigade continues the fight east, towards Port Stanley on the east side of the island, and there's really a ring around Stanley of mountains.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for the brigade, as their lines extend, they have some real challenges as they think through that. And so, you know, just give us a quick overview of how does the design of the campaign at this point to really invest Stanley?
Well, I think what was interesting for me at this point was that Brigadier Thompson is controlling the tempo by slowing the battalions down at points, because he, as we mentioned, he's focusing on getting this artillery ammunition forwards, moving the guns. So it all has to be a very deliberate process, which was interesting to me, because I always thought you would be trying to drive your subordinates forward at that level. But actually, he's often holding them back. But once they manage to get a process going that's almost like a drill, where they're moving the guns forward and the ammo forward and the helicopters, they're then able to free up some of the helicopters to help carry rucks and people at points to get them further forward. And then they get towards the high features, which are to the west of Port Stanley, and that's when they start to formulate their plan for attack. You've got the 5th Infantry Brigade that have landed at this point as well, and they're involved. And it's quite interesting how during this phase of the campaign, they're able to reorbit within those two brigades, and they pass one of the battalions to the other brigade, and then they get that battalion back later on. The apparent ease with which they do that in this book, I think, is quite telling, because I think that's having seen people do similar things at a lower level, I think that's an incredibly complicated thing to do, to retask org like that.
And especially without roads and helicopters.
Yeah.
Your description, yeah, that's what stands out to me, is to the degree at which, General Thompson exerts a substantial amount of control over the battalions. And what we end up with is a series of sequential battalion actions. Now, we've gained contact through patrols and with observation and indirect fire of really all of the Argentine defense that's arrayed around Port Stanley, but very deliberately does it sequentially, precisely to manage the guns, mm-hmm. and to be able to provide support, which looks a lot like what our live fire up at Pisan looks like, a series of battalion attacks that are integrated and synchronized, but requires the choreography from the brigade to maximize fires.
Yeah, and he's forever flying or walking around the battlefield to meet with his commanders, to get eyes on the enemy positions, see his forward positions, that helps shape his decision-making throughout. Something that I've inferred that isn't necessarily the case, but I like to think it probably is that he's judging these characters very shrewdly, and he's picking his horses for courses throughout. So
you're going to have to horses for courses.
So he's there's a bit where he talks about the structure of a battalion and how it works, and how a CO is king within the battalion, and how his job is brigade commander is to sit over these three families effectively, and they each have their own character and their own sort of feel to them, and he's got to try and understand what that is. So he knows that this battalion is going to be better at these type of activities than perhaps this one, but this one will be better at those types of activities. So he never says it directly, but I think it's implied that he's picking which battalion he's sending onto which objective based on
unit personality.
Yes, the unit personality.
And I think there's very much different commanders and different units are better suited for different problems.
Yeah.
That absolutely, now that you put it that way, that absolutely stands out. Let's talk, so one of the things that's fascinating about this is, the Argentines have very good night vision equipment, heavy machine guns. Although many of the forces are conscript, there are marine units there. I mean, this is and they've had a fair bit of time to prepare, and they've dug in and they've put in protective obstacles. They've put in minefields as tactical obstacles and prepared positions. One of the big critiques, having read a number of books from the Argentine perspective as well, as the British perspective, is really the lack of patrolling from the Argentine units. And this is something that the British do really well. You know, as you've kind of read this and gone through it, I mean, how does the patrolling fit into the culture of these units, and then and how is that used to the advantage of the British forces in this fight?
So patrolling is still very much prevalent in the culture of those units and the wider British Army. But for instance, in a parabattle group, their recce platoon is referred to as the patrols platoon rather than the recce platoon, which implies a slightly different task. I think they're generally used for similar things, but that shows the level of importance that they place on patrolling. And patrolling, I think, having read this and also from what I've observed in the last 3 years working in collective training, is really what enables people to win. Generally speaking, it's an enabling activity or it's an offensive action. But if you can conduct effective patrolling, you're keeping the enemy at arm's reach and you're collecting information. And that information is what allows you to have a better plan for the fires and then get that HE onto the target so that you can then maneuver effectively unhindered. There were a couple of occasions where he mentioned there were Argentinian patrols out there as well. And I think they probably had the disadvantage of the fact that defense is very difficult. Yeah. They're on mountaintops in freezing cold weather and they've got to defend. I think psychologically that is a much harder activity than having to attack. It's much easier to plan an attack and go out and do that than it is to sit static, patrolling day in, day out, not finding anything, but maintaining high levels of discipline. So I think the patrolling is very important, and it's something I would certainly take away from this and from the time I've spent here and at the Combat Ready Training Centre, is that those units that patrol, they detect the enemy earlier, and it's a race to find, really. We're all trying to find, fix, strike, exploit, or whatever framework you use. The first rung on the ladder is find. If I can find you and you can't find me, I've got a much, much better advantage now.
And so, you know, in 41 years removed, you know, now, you know, small UAS, greater proliferation of signal and electronic warfare detection devices. I mean, the ability to sense mm-hmm. is much greater. And there was electronic warfare in this campaign as well on both sides, but obviously that's evolved. And certainly the small UAS, I mean, the ability to sense and see our adversaries is only increased. The British do that in this campaign primarily through patrolling, dismounted reconnaissance to great effect. I mean, they're able to identify main battle positions, and what's really key is identify the obstacles mm-hmm. That are in front of them. And so, you know, in several instances, they're navigating their way through these obstacles, or they're reducing obstacles out of direct fire contact in support of future operations.
Yeah, finding the minefields and trying to navigate routes through minefields for battalions. It's an interesting part of it. But there are points where they attacked Tupara again on one of the other objectives, attacked straight through a minefield. And I think they did so knowingly, and they took the doctrinal template and knew that they would take X percentage of casualties doing so and just planned accordingly. I'm not exactly sure how many casualties they took doing that.
But. Yeah, and in several instances, they've also task organized sappers with some of these patrols as well to help reduce and mark some of these obstacles.
Yeah.
The massing of fires in the fight for the hills is pretty important. And echelon meant with battalion mortars as well. To maintain, because these fights last all night. These are not hour-long gunfights. These are, all night, 8 to 10 hour fights against an enemy that has, in many instances, alternate and supplementary positions in depth.
Yeah.
And so this is which the lessons from Goose Green are passed. And again, the British are employing Milan, which is equivalent, similar to a javelin, anti-tank munitions to reduce bunkers. Laws, Carl Gustav's, and then hand grenades. But this is a tough, close fight that in some instances even results in the use of bayonets at close range.
Yeah, and I think the sustainment planning at the battalion level is very interesting, and it comes back to the point we made before about just being tough as well. They were having to carry everything, less artillery ammo, basically, because that's all of the transport they had was dedicated to artillery movement as a priority. So the mortar ammo was being carried by the rifle companies. So these people were having their 80 pounds of kit, and then as they're stepping off through the start line, they're probably being given a couple of belts of machine gun ammunition and a mortar greenie, which is two 81 millimeter mortar bombs. They're then carrying them up to an RV point where they drop them off, which is near one of the mortar firing points where the mortars will set up later on. And then they're doing that leapfrogging from objective to objective.
I think, you know, one of the things, you know, that comes out is, so one, you know, it's doable to move long distances under load. And they do it, right? They fight from the west side of the island to the east side of the island. Two, the leaders on the ground very soberly make choices about, okay, we have to refit this force. We've just moved, you know, 40 kilometers dismounted. We have to refit this force, rebuild combat power. So there is an acknowledgement that, like, after this movement in this terrain, that they have to rebuild combat power to be able to do the close fight. And then there's a tailoring of the loads for the assault, because everybody realizes we can't do this with 80, we can't attack an 80 pound rucksacks.
Yeah.
And so there's, it's the learning that occurs in the organizations is, you know, stands out. And in many instances, the star majors being like, hey, what are we doing here?
Yeah. There's a point in there where they fly in some rations and the people on the receiving end hadn't eaten in 24 hours. But I think the training people get here prepares them well for that kind of austerity.
Yeah. What are some of the big lessons? What are the big takeaways that you took from this book and the campaign?
So that patrolling, which has already been mentioned, is probably the one that stood out for me most. He appointed one of his principal staff officers as a patrol master when they got to the eastern side of the island towards Stanley, as they were shaping. In the sort of shaping phases for those high features, and every battalion was sending out patrols all the time. So the place was like an ant colony of patrols. And that information flow from the sensor, which is the people on the patrol, back to the battalion, where they then mark up their overlays and terrain overlays and sit temps and things. And then that information then back to the brigade, to this patrol master. Really stood out. And I think that hasn't, for me, I don't think that's changed for an infantry unit. The units that patrol aggressively on collective training are the ones that generally have a better time when they encounter the enemy. Another standout thing for me was simplicity. He kept the schemes of maneuver generally quite simple. I know we mentioned about retask org of a unit, which they did with apparent ease. But generally, his attacks were not complicated. The maneuver plan wasn't particularly complicated. It was preceded by lots of artillery, and then they would attack from what they decided was the most favorable direction based on the terrain and the enemy laydown. But once the attack went, it was generally speaking sequential, or at one point simultaneous two battle groups up. But he always had a reserve. He was always pretty well balanced, and he kept it simple. And I think that's really important as well. There's a temptation I see for people to try and overcomplicate things, to think outside the box. By all means, think outside the box, but keep the plan simple, because when you come under contact and commanders start dying, you can't manually control what's going on. You need your subordinates to understand the plan to the level that they can just execute it without your input whatsoever. And I think that he certainly achieved that.
At one of the battalion actions, there's a pretty, at the battalion level, there's a pretty complex scheme maneuver that the lead company comes into direct fire contact well, I think it's initiated by a soldier stepping on a landmine, and then, and the plan's out the door, and we just got to go at the enemy. You know, so the battalion puts mortars, suppresses the mortars, and it really turns into, you know, a battalion attack, a penetration, and passing one company after the other through, because they're not able to envelop. I mean, they're able to, the element that comes in direct fire contacts establishes a base of fire, and then it's like, let's just get on with it.
Yeah.
No, I agree, and it stands out. I mean, the simplicity of a lot of HE in a simple scheme maneuver, violently executed, you know, goes a long way. You know, I think the privation and hardship of this campaign, you know, you talked about the, you know, from the Argentine perspective, I mean, at this point in the campaign, they're having a hard time getting resupplied. It had been in position for almost 6 weeks, horrible weather conditions. Many of those soldiers didn't come with the proper gear, you know, weren't equipped with the proper gear. And then the British walking all across the island, and this is a tough place to fight.
Yeah.
Privation and hardship are absolutely, you know, present, omnipresent in this fight, and really violent.
Yeah.
Really violent.
Well, I think one of the things that stood out for me on that is how he introduces all of his characters, and he talks about who they are and what their role is. But then he always introduces a bit of extracurricular information about them as well. And I think that shows that, or he's demonstrating, A, that he knows his people very well, and knows more than just them professionally, knows them as a human being, but also he puts stock in these extracurricular activities. He considers that the mark of a man rather than just their soldiering ability. So that everyone he mentions is either a rugby player or an Everest mountaineer or an alpinist or a cross-country skier or a cricketer or something like that. And I think it's for me, I think that just shows the level of importance in having people in your organization that push their envelope of comfort on a regular basis. They're adventurous, they're tough, yeah. Tough people, generally speaking. You've got to have something other than just your profession, I think,
yeah.
In that sense.
You've got to live hard to be hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, as you bring that up, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, the company commanders that I had when I was a battalion commander. You know, one of them was a college-level football player, like absolute tough as nails. You know, one of them stalked a mountain goat for 2 days straight in Alaska. You know, and, you know, another one of them, you know, was a rugby player and just kind of put himself through hardship on a regular basis up in the environment in Alaska. And so, you know, there is this... they're intangibles into what we do, and you know, I'm with you. I think it's in encouraging people to do difficult things, mm-hmm. and to get comfortable being uncomfortable. And I think you know, team sports do that for people, but you know, doing tough stuff.
Yeah, it's easy to focus just on the professional output side of it, but I think it is important for our people to. Some people need to be pushed. Other people just. They do it naturally, but I think we need to encourage and give time for our people to push them out of their comfort zone.
Yeah. You know, so I've got a couple that stand out to me, too, from this campaign that I think warrants, you know, reflection when we think about large-scale combat operations in the modern era. So the first one is, you know, this idea of the transparency of the battlefield, something that we talk a lot about here at JRTC and you know, the ability to be sensed and then to be attacked with long-range fires. The brigade command post is attacked by Argentine air.
Yeah.
And the brigade aid station.
Yeah.
The roll two is attacked with Argentine air.
Yeah.
You know, and the Argentines don't know it's an aid station. It's inside a series of buildings. After that, the British paint, I think, the buildings, red crosses on the buildings. But you know, if it was true 41 years ago, it's going to be true today.
Yep.
That these sustaining entities and these C2 entities really have to work to be, to one, look unimportant.
Yeah.
And two, be agile and mobile.
Well, that's the thing. So they set the brigade headquarters up first, right next to a flagpole in San Carlos Bay. So there is a natural human tendency to anchor yourself when static. If you answer your phone on the street, you go and stand next to a lamppost or like move off to the side of the pavement or sidewalk. I think that potentially the same is true when you're setting up a static defensive position or a main command post. And I have seen it on collective training as well. People will set up the main command post right next to a TRP or a target reference point, so the lone tree on the hill or a radio mast or something like that. They realize they did it. They took the flag down and sawed the flagpole down, but it's just being aware of those sorts of things. And that wasn't when they weren't at that location when they got bombed. But it's sometimes I think we don't help ourselves and we just need to be more aware and do perhaps the unnatural thing when sighting some of these positions.
Yeah, and I think that's, part of this is, I think it's the value of reading, right? The and study of our profession. So we can learn a lot of these things vicariously from the experiences of others.
Yeah.
Likewise, I think it's talking to people that have come through rotations here and, okay, what did you experience and learn? Like, let's make new and different mistakes.
Yes.
Not the ones that have been made before us. And then the other, one of General Thompson's, big concerns with he didn't want to lose anybody in a ship. So it's this big emphasis on rapidly transitioning from ship to shore. And I think that, part of a joint forcible entry, whether you're doing it by ship, whether you're doing it by fixed wing, by rotary wing, by vehicle, it doesn't really matter. It's that the danger inherent when transition from movement to maneuver and how vulnerable we potentially are. Mm-hmm. And when 5th Brigade comes, they keep people inside a ship, the Sir Galahad, and the Sir Galahad struck by an exocet, tremendous casualties to the unit, which is obviously a huge tragedy, but is a lesson for all of us that the vulnerability on the modern battlefield, the lethality of the modern battlefield, to be sensed first and foremost, and then to be struck, and even though at this point the Argentine military is running out of exocets, the air threat is being reduced a little bit by the British Royal Navy. Land-based exocet, which they had taken, memory serves, had taken off a ship and repurposed as a ground launcher, which is this. We can't underestimate our enemies. I mean,
yeah.
Our enemies, thinking, living, breathing. They're just like us. They love their country. They're also gonna solve problems.
There are a lot of smart people out there.
Right.
Yeah.
And this always thinking about the worst case scenario, and in our profession inherently, small C conservative has to be a conservative kind of view of, okay, what's the hazards and risk out there, and being very clear eyed about the risks that we confront. Because this is a campaign that is incredibly violent. I mean, number of ships lost on the British side, number of ships on the Argentine side, and 100 plus aircraft shot down, hundreds of dead, many hundreds wounded, life altering injuries for a pretty small force. I think it's what commends this campaign to study. It's austere, it's expeditionary, and it's against an adversary, that has a lot of capability.
Yeah.
The British are outnumbered.
Yeah.
In this. And, it takes a tremendous amount of grit for the British to carry the day. Not from this book, but one of my favorite quotes from the campaign, either from a book or a documentary, is, a British corporal's asked, like, how did you do it? And he says, well, it's the little things.
Yep.
It's like if you have a pair of dry socks in your Bergen and your mate's got wet feet, you give up your dry socks. It's you look after your mates.
Yeah.
And reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Command Sergeant Major Hall, the former Sergeant Major for the Ranger Regiment. The fundamental determinant of success or failure in combat is how a soldier feels about his or her peers and immediate leader. And in all of the material I've read on the Falklands campaign. You know, the commandos and the paras in particular, there is this deep unit cohesion born out of shared hardship and training. You know, the commandos had come from training in Norway before this campaign. You know, the paras obviously, you know, jumping out of airplanes and hard training, and the importance of hard training, not only of what it teaches us, mm-hmm. but how it causes us to redefine what our limitations are, but also to kind of bond us together through shared hardship.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And we see it here all the time, people forging those bonds and memories through hardship that they'll probably carry for the rest of their lives. And I'm glad you mentioned the little things as well, because I'm a big advocate of the little things that are the things that make the big difference. Some people win Victoria Crosses or Medals of Honor, and they're obviously very highly valued, but the soldier that wakes up in the morning and cleans their weapon and makes sure that it works properly, it's the cumulative effect of all of those people that wins the day in the end, I believe.
No, I completely agree. Hey, so appreciate you joining to talk about this campaign and this book. Three Commando Brigade in the Falklands, No Picnic by Julian Thompson, a great book, you know, and I think one of these that I've read a couple times to help me think about large-scale combat operations against near-peer adversaries. What I'd like to close with is, you know, you're finishing up your time at the Joint Readiness Training Center here at Fort Johnson. What have you learned from this experience, and what advice would you give leaders preparing for this kind of training event?
So I've learned a lot, far more than I can just say in 30 seconds now, but the importance of patrolling, we've mentioned it before, I think it's worth mentioning again. That is the thing that will stick with me when I go out of here and then one day go back and hopefully do company command. That race to find is very important. The importance of review. When you come through and do collective training, review kind of happens to you. But when you go away from collective training, you've got to schedule the time to review yourselves. Because ultimately, I believe that ability for us to candidly review is the ability that will enable us to win any campaign that we may go on in the future. Because we may not win the first battle, but if we can honestly look back at it and reflect and identify the issues and solve the issues, we'll have a much better chance of winning the second battle. So we have to inculcate that into our ethos and culture. And I firmly believe we've got some of the best people in the world, really. We've got some really, really intelligent, motivated people who care. They look after their soldiers. And I'm sure that collectively, if we turn our mind to any of these problems, we'll be able to solve whatever comes ahead of us. And then the last bit of advice I'd say to anyone coming through on JSSC is don't forget to enjoy it. There's no other job like it in the world. And we mentioned you'll forge relationships and friendships and create memories that you'll probably carry with you for the rest of your life. It's great fun. And one day you'll be too old to do it and you'll look back and think, actually, it wasn't that bad. So yeah. I think that's...
Well, thanks for joining us. And you know, I'm gonna hit on a couple of those. You know, so I think this, you know, winning is this, I mean, we're in a profession that is existential. I mean, what we do determines whether or not, you know, the fates of nations and whether or not people live or die. And so, you know, learning, or organizations that learn fastest win. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of humility to do what you describe, which is to accurately look at yourself and say, okay, hey, here's where we're at, honestly, right now, and this is the work in front of us. And I think that's the true mark of professionals and units that do it before they come here, and units that do it during, and units that do it after rotation, experience the most growth. And you know, at the end of the day, this isn't the World Cup. So it's my shout out to my allies out there. This is the train up before the World Cup,
yeah.
You know, before the big match. And so we've really got to have a mindset of what we're going to get the most out of this experience to prepare ourselves for what could be the worst day of our life going forward. You know, the patrolling, That's the secret sauce of Geronimo. I mean, it's what they do. They constantly maintain contact. And they're going to do it through, you know, EW sensors. They're going to do it with small UAS. And they, and when the weather goes bad, they've always got patrols out. And they're always dismounted and moving around and seeking to confirm or deny enemy locations.
You know, they don't let you breathe out there.
They don't let you breathe. They give you no space. And then, you know, I couldn't agree more. You know, I was fortunate. I got to do a rotation down in Australia, their CTC. And we'd flown 18 hours in flight rig, jumped from Alaska into Australia. I'd always wanted to go to Australia. And Shoalwater Bay is no different than Fort Johnson, JRTC. It just has kangaroos instead of wild horses. And, you know, no vehicles. And after walking through the swamps there and crossing a couple rivers, I was feeling a little bit sorry for myself. And my battalion Sergeant Major Hansen, you know, looks over at me at 2 a.m. with a giant grin on his face. And it's like, isn't this amazing? We'll never get to do this again. And I think you're exactly right. It's embracing the moment and really treasuring the shared hardship, which is tough when you're in it. But not only makes memories, but really has a generational impact going forward. So appreciate your time here today with me, but more importantly, you know, what you've done for the U.S. Army and what you've done really for your own military, you know, growing in the profession going forward. So thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, sir. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on The Crucible, the JRTC Experience.
The Joint Readiness Training Center is the premier crucible training experience. We prepare units to fight and win in the most complex environments against world-class opposing forces. We are America's leadership laboratory. Again, we'd like to thank our guests for participating. This podcast was created and produced by Mr. John Mabes. It was recorded and edited by Chief Thomas Rich and researched by First Lieutenant Anthony Cho. Intro vocals were done by Mr. Robert Chopper. Special thanks to Captain Jermaine Branch and Mr. Jeff England from Public Affairs. Be sure to like and follow us on social media to keep up with the latest warfighting TTPs learned through the crucible that is the Joint Readiness Training Center. Follow us by going to https://linktr.ee/JRTC We'd like to thank our partners at the Center for Army Lessons Learned of the Combined Arms Center, especially the JRTC Call Observations Detachment. Be sure to follow them on social media as well. Follow them at https://www.army.mil/CALL Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review us wherever you listen or watch your podcasts, and be sure to stay tuned for more in the near future. The Crucible, the JRTC Experience, is a product of the Joint Readiness Training Center.